Welcome to World Affairs, the weekly broadcast of the World Affairs Council. I'm Jane Wales, CEO. Globalization has created tremendous wealth in Silicon Valley, in Bangalore, even Beijing. It's lifted millions from poverty worldwide. But it's also created tremendous disparities, and large swaths of our own population have been experiencing a declining standard of living. So in this episode, we'll focus on those who've been left behind and the resulting political backlash here in the U.S. and abroad. In this hour, we'll hear from Edward Alden. He's a senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations. This event was recorded in San Francisco before a World Affairs audience, and the broadcast is made possible by the generous support of Chevron. And now to our conversation. We're delighted that Ted Alden is here. He's the senior fellow, as you've just heard, at the Council on Foreign Relations. He's focused on immigration policy over the years, but mostly on the whole overall issue of economic competitiveness. He not only is a senior fellow, but he also is the director of the Council's Renewing America publication series, which I need to ask you about. He was bureau chief of the Financial Times in Washington, D.C. before joining the Council. And as I say, his work focused on immigration and U.S. trade policy. More broadly, he has just done a book that is exceedingly interesting, and I think you're going to stay in and maybe do some book signings for it. But its title is "Failure to Adjust: How Americans Got Left Behind in the Global Economy." So that's what we're going to focus on tonight. So Ted, thank you, and please join me in welcoming him.
Thanks so much.
Now, in your book, you say that the problem isn't so much globalization and the sort of economic integration that implies, as it is our failure on the policy side to address the downside, to deal with the dislocations. What are we doing? Who's gaining and who's losing?
In my book, and thank you, Jane, it's great to be here with you and to be at the World Affairs Council here in San Francisco. In my book, I call it the Field of Dreams problem. And our Field of Dreams problem was the thinking over the decades was, if we build this system of fair global trade rules, then that will be sufficient. The U.S. will find ways to prosper within that system of global trade rules, even without a kind of concerted strategy coming at the national level, even without a lot of thinking about what do we do to help those people who might be hurt by import competition. We assumed that if the rules were fair, then the chips would fall in a way that was favorable to most or all Americans. And I think in retrospect, that was a little too optimistic. I think there's no question that on balance, globalization has been a good thing for the United States. It's been a good thing for the world. In the last couple of decades, we've seen more people lifted out of poverty worldwide than in any other comparable period in human history. But it's also clear that there were people whose lives were upended pretty significantly, largely in the manufacturing sector, a lot of them in the middle parts of this country. And as we discovered in November, that was the making of a political backlash. I mean, Donald Trump won the election because he took Wisconsin and Michigan and Pennsylvania and Ohio and North Carolina, manufacturing-dependent states, which were hard hit, particularly in the 2000s, by trade competition. Mm-hmm. And so the failure to kind of think that through, I think, has had some real political consequences.
Yeah, and I think there's sort of different policy impulses. The Republican Party is more inclined to advocate corporate tax cuts, lessening regulations so that more jobs will be created, while Democrats argue for retraining programs and free community college education and other efforts to ensure that the benefits of globalization are more evenly felt. But let's talk about the various policy levers that either were or were not pulled.
Sure.
And I think I'll start with maybe a reddish herring. I don't know if it is a red herring.
A pink herring.
But that's trade.
Yeah.
In the campaign, virtually every candidate ran against free trade and ran against the various trade agreements that were on the table, TPP and of course the NAFTA itself. Yeah. So to what extent is trade responsible for the loss of manufacturing jobs?
I think the answer is partly responsible, and maybe more responsible than the economics profession and most of us realized. a lot of what got me thinking about the issues that I raised in this book was research that's been done by David Autor at MIT and Gordon Hanson at the University of California, San Diego, and David Dorn, their third co-author. And they looked at the impact of import competition from China in the 2000s. And it was very significant. Mm. I mean, at the end of the day, if you look at manufacturing job loss, the biggest culprit is technology, improving productivity. We still make as much as a country as we ever did. We do it with fewer workers. So if you had to point to culprit number one, it would be technology. But the impact of trade was not insignificant. There are debates over what percentage of the job loss. But what happened in the 2000s was quite striking. If you look at the manufacturing sector. So manufacturing is a share of the labor force has been shrinking for a long time. That goes back to the 1960s. But the total number of manufacturing jobs in the United States was relatively stable at about 17 million all the way from the early 80s to the end of the 2000s, even as production was going up. So we were getting more and more efficient. We were making more and more stuff. But the labor force was fairly stable. In the 2000s, it fell off a cliff. Mm-hmm. We lost 6 million manufacturing jobs in the 2000s. I'm not saying it was caused by, but it was coincidental with China's entry into the World Trade Organization mm-hmm. and the mm-hmm. huge increase in Chinese imports to the United States. And to get back to the political impact, we have to remember those were jobs of a particular sort. A lot of these were unionized jobs. They paid relatively high wages. You look at the auto plants, $25, $30 an hour to people with fairly modest levels of education, high school, maybe a bit of community college. When those jobs went away in the places that they went away, there were very, very few good options for those right. people. They didn't have right. a soft landing possibility.
Right. So when the president put forth his I think it was the trade policy agenda, is that what it was referred to?
Yeah.
What was right and what was wrong about it, or have you just covered that?
I mean, I think what was right about it was a need to focus a lot more systematically on enforcing the trade rules. I think, you know, some of China's gains in trade are legitimate. China's a big economy. It's got a big workforce. They're you know, getting more and more productive year after year. But it's also pretty clear that China does a lot of things that skirt very much on the edge of trade rules. I would argue in a lot of cases violate them pretty clearly. And the Trump administration's new trade agenda says we're going to get a lot more serious about this than the United States has been in the past. I think that part is right. I think the part that's not right is imagining that if we fix the problems on the trade side, suddenly all these factory jobs are going to come back. Right. They're not. You know, the manufacturing jobs of the future are different than the manufacturing jobs of the past. And I think there are things we can do in trade policy to help our manufacturing sector and other sectors, the services economy, which is increasingly traded. But it's not going to bring a lot of jobs back.
Yeah. So if you were handed the job of renegotiating NAFTA, what would you try to preserve and what would you try to jettison?
Well, if I were handed the job of renegotiating NAFTA, I'd negotiate the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which is exactly what the Obama administration did. I mean, if you really... It's kind of funny because President Obama, Trump was not the first one to run on a trade skeptic platform. President Obama, the 2008 campaign, ran as an opponent of NAFTA, was quite skeptical of trade policy for the first couple of years of his administration, had promised, in fact, in the 2008 campaign that he would renegotiate NAFTA, never kind of took it on frontally the way Donald Trump's going to. Donald Trump is going to demand a renegotiation of NAFTA, but he kind of did an end run, which is to negotiate this larger regional deal with Japan and 10 other countries, including Canada and Mexico. And there were some significant revisions to the rules. I mean, you know, a big one that is nowhere in NAFTA is rules governing digital trade, which is a growing part of the economy and obviously incredibly important in this part of the world. The TPP had a series of provisions having to do with, you know, not being able to force companies to locate their servers in a particular country, not being able to tax digital trade, and other provisions very beneficial to the tech companies. Even little things like access for U.S. dairy farmers to Canada, we couldn't get that under the NAFTA. The Canadians have a very protected system for their dairy farmers, a long political history of that. In TPP, they actually opened up somewhat because they wanted to be part of the deal. They saw opportunities in Japan and elsewhere. So if I were to do it, I'd say, let's go back to the TPP and undelete it.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I assume it is too late to go and renegotiate our role in the TPP. They're happily going forth with their own agreements without us.
No, right? I don't think so. So, I mean, the Trans-Pacific Partnership is an interesting history because the U.S. didn't launch it. It was several small countries, New Zealand and Chile. I think Brunei was one of them. I'm forgetting the fourth. And they started it many years ago, and the U.S. latched onto this as a vehicle for promoting free trade in the Asia-Pacific, which is a long-standing goal for the United States. It goes back to the mid-1980s with the formation of APEC. But the U.S. was instrumental in putting the deal together. And trade deals are basically, the language is a balance of concessions. So the basic idea is, you know, I, Japan, will lower my trade barriers, normally tariffs, which are the import taxes that we charge on goods, on a range of products. So the Japanese have done it, for instance, would have done it in the TPP on beef and pork and rice and dairy. Their agricultural market had been very protected for a long time. That would have been big opportunities for the United States. In exchange, the United States was going to do things in other areas, like phase out its 25% tariff on light trucks, which mm-hmm. is a big thing for the U.S. auto industry. If you pull the United States out of that, then the whole balance of concessions is gone. I mean, if they want to do the TPP, they're going to have to completely renegotiate it from scratch, right? I mean, some of the rules might work. I think what the rest of the TPP countries are doing is they're keeping the corpse alive. They're saying, you know, we might go ahead, we might do it without the United States, in the hope that somebody will get to Donald Trump and say, look, if what you're really concerned about is U.S. trade deficits, our biggest trade deficit is with China, and the TPP provides a lot of leverage against China. Mm-hmm. I think the hope is that at some point the president may reconsider. I'm not optimistic about it, but I think that's
so. That's trade. What about immigration? To what extent do we need robust immigration in order for our economy to thrive?
Yeah, that's a really complicated question. So let me just say one thing at the outset. You read a lot today about the growth of populism around the world in the United States and Europe. I mean, obviously Marine Le Pen didn't win the French election, but she got a lot more votes than her party had ever had before. In Europe, the issue is much more immigration. Mm-hmm. Here, it's been more trade. But I think in a lot of ways, in both places, what you're seeing is a discomfort with the very rapid pace of change. I mean, one of the things that surprised me when I researched my book was how rapid the U.S. entry into the global economy was. So I start the book in the year I was born, and I'm going to admit to everybody how old I am, which is 1961. And I say I was born into the greatest autarky the world has ever known. And what I meant by that was we were reasonably self-sufficient. Mm-hmm. The United States didn't have high tariffs. We weren't particularly protectionist. We just made everything better than everybody else. We traded very little with the rest of the world. Between then and sort of the late 1990s, the impact of trade on the economy tripled. That was a really, really rapid integration into the global economy, much less so for the Europeans. They'd always traded. The Canadians had always traded. This was different for the United States. Same is true on immigration. When I was born, the United States was less diverse than it had ever been at any time in its history. You know, you go back to the early 20th century, the foreign-born population was about 13%. And then as a result of the quota laws of the 1920s and the Great Depression, World War II, by the time I was born, the foreign-born population of the United States was only 4%. Today, it's back up to 13 again, and it's going to exceed the levels of the early 20th century. A lot of that came out of the Immigration Act of 65. So again, big change. And it's really interesting if you look at it regionally. The places where the change has been most rapid are in the central parts of the country. In the Midwest, in the South, not in the coast, even though most immigrants come to the cities. American cities have had immigrants for a long time. I mean, we're pretty comfortable with them in the cities. Immigrants are now settling in parts of the country that haven't seen immigrants for decades and decades. And so I think you have this general discomfort with change that people are reacting against. I didn't completely answer your question. I'm going to answer your question. My worry about this is that the discomfort with change and the backlash that it's created is really going to cut off the lifeblood of a lot of our most dynamic regions, including this one. Mm-hmm. You know, if you look at the role that immigrants have played in the formation of Silicon Valley, for example, or at our universities here, it's incredibly important. And I think, you know, one of the, for a long time, the, you know, the goose that laid the golden egg for the United States has been the fact that we attract a lion's share of the world's best and brightest immigrants.
Yeah.
And as a result of you know, what happened in November and the backlash against immigration, it's going to play out, already is playing out in a bunch of ways in this administration. Fewer people are going to come here. I spend a lot of time going to universities, and every university I go to, I ask the administrative folks, you know, what's happening with foreign student applications and enrollment. They're down substantially everywhere. Since November. That's going to be a real blow.
Yeah. No, I mean, the risk of losing a lot of talent in ways that we will never fully be able to trace, right? You don't know what the impact is of an unwelcoming environment.
Yeah.
So, but as you think about, I'm just going to stick with the economic impact for a while. Obviously, here in Northern California, or any part of California, a real clampdown on trade would have a pretty devastating effect on our economy.
Yeah.
Are you seeing a kind of an understanding of that, even in Washington, even in the face of this populist backlash that we're,
you know, my answer is yes and no. There's a real divide in this administration, and there are folks in the administration who have a pretty hard line on trade, including the Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross, Bob Lighthizer, who's going to be the next U.S. Trade Representative. He might have even been confirmed today. The Senate was going to do it imminently. Peter Navarro, who's a California academic, who's in the White House. And, you know, the Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin seems to be a little more pro-business on this. Gary Cohn, former Goldman Sachs executive who heads the National Economic Council. They seem to be a little more business-friendly on this. But there are, you know, there are things in motion in this administration that could come back to bite the successful trading parts of the United States. You know, just to take one example, the administration has launched for the first time in 20 years an investigation into whether imports of steel and aluminum are threatening the U.S. industrial base and therefore jeopardizing U.S. national security. If the answer that comes back from the Commerce Department, which is run by Wilbur Ross, who made his fortune in the steel industry as a result of the Bush tariffs in 2001, there's a long story there. But, you know, Commerce Department's answer on this is likely to be yes. And under that law, the United States could put very broad import restrictions on steel. If that happens, other countries may retaliate, and they're going to retaliate against our export competitive industries. Mm-hmm. You know, I was in Seattle last night. I'm a little more worried about Boeing than maybe some of the companies here in California. But our successful exporters are going to be the retaliation target if we start blocking imports from other places.
Absolutely, yeah. So that's immigration and trade we just touched upon. But what about the rest? If the policy prescription that comes out of the White House is, in essence, reduce corporate taxes, lighten the load of regulation, jobs will be created. You mentioned automation. Will jobs be created?
Yeah. I'm in favor of reducing the corporate tax. Let me put this in a little bit of context. So the way I structured my book, because I had this big set of ideas out of 25 years of covering this stuff. I started as a reporter in the middle of the NAFTA negotiations and following the Uruguay round that led to the creation of the World Trade Organization, following the U.S.-Japan auto fights in which we threatened to put 100% import tariff on all Japanese luxury automobiles unless they bought more American cars. For the record, they still don't buy American cars. Basically, I was trying to make sense of this period of history that I'd witnessed and really the declining support for trade over that period. And I was trying to figure out how do I put all this stuff together. And I stumbled on a memo that was written to President Nixon in 1971. And it was slightly awkward because the author of the memo was Pete Peterson, who made, you know, $1 billion+ with Blackstone Group and gives money to many research organizations, including mine, the Council on Foreign Relations. But Nixon had hired Peterson as the first head of what was then called the White House Council on International Economic Policy. It was the forerunner of the National Economic Council. And the first thing that Peterson did was to sit down and write this long memo to the president called The United States in a Changing World Economy. And he basically predicted almost everything that happened over the next 40 years. He said, look, we are moving from this very self-sufficient economy to a much more competitive global economy. You know, we already see the Japanese are dominating television sets, and they're exporting steel, and they're starting to build cars. He foresaw the rise of the East Asian Rim, seeing that, a lot of what we came to know as the Tigers were going to be very competitive. And he laid out a whole series of prescriptions for what the United States needed to do to respond to this. Some of it was trade rules. We need to be serious about enforcing trade rules. Some of it was currency. We need to make sure that countries don't artificially devalue their currencies to gain a competitive advantage, CF China in the mid-2000s. But he said we also need to do a lot of stuff at home. We've got to make sure corporate tax rates are competitive so that we attract investment. The United States today has the highest top-line corporate tax rate in the advanced world. He said we've got to invest in infrastructure so we can get our products to market. We've got to invest in research and development so we can lead in innovation. And he argued for generous programs of adjustment assistance to places where manufacturing jobs disappeared, including actually assistance to the communities, not just to the workers themselves. And my whole book kind of traces how well did we do in implementing all these things that Peterson saw in 1971. And on most of them, the answer is we didn't do terribly well.
Well, speaking of infrastructure, the president did run in part on the notion of a massive infrastructure project, which would, in fact, I would think, create great jobs, but we haven't heard about that. Where does that, what do you think its fate will be?
I know, he seems to have put it on the back burner, which baffles me politically, right? If you want to do something that actually helps the people who put you in office, a big infrastructure program would really do it, right? Yeah. Taking healthcare away from them doesn't do it. But that seems to have been their first priority. The infrastructure one really baffles me, because it just seems to me it ought to have support across the political spectrum. It creates jobs. It, you know, helps people get around the country. Transportation is so important. It's good for our competitiveness. You deepen ports, invest in broadband. That's great for innovation and entrepreneurship. There's so much low-hanging fruit there. Capital is extraordinarily cheap. You know, borrowing is easy and inexpensive. Mm-hmm. And there have been a lot of proposals out there, including one that the Obama administration pushed very hard for, to create the conditions to allow the private sector to put a lot of money in this, what they call the infrastructure bank, which would be sort of $10 billion in government seed capital to bring the private sector much more into infrastructure construction. There are a lot of pension funds that are looking for projects that pay back in 30, 40, 50 years. Never done that at a national level. A lot of states are trying to do it. California's trying to do it and others. But it's just been this big whiff over the last decade, and it just seems to be this sort of allergy in Washington to using the government in any sort of effective way as an economic development tool, that somehow that's an illegitimate role for the federal government, even though, you know, I mean, the Eisenhower administration, the Republican, built the national highway system, right?
Yeah, so
very puzzling to me.
Well, but there's also a drop-off in R&D, both in the private sector and in government. What do you see? Is that trend going to keep going downward, or do you expect that there'll be at least more of an appetite for investment in R&D?
Yeah, I mean, I know less about the private sector side. Mm-hmm. I've focused more on the government side. I suspect that R&D funding coming out of Washington is going to continue to decline. Mm-hmm. I mean, we're talking about pretty steep budget cuts. The Trump budget, I mean, it's going to get enacted as he has suggested it, but they're basically steep cuts in that budget for everything except homeland security and defense. I mean, we all know that the lion's share of government money now goes into Medicare and Social Security and Medicaid. Everything else is getting squeezed out, including all of these things that are actually critical for our long-term competitiveness, research and development, education, skills training. All of these programs are getting squeezed. And unless there's some rethinking in Washington, both on, I think, the level of taxation, I think, you know, taxes probably need to rise in some places, and on actually curbing the long-term growth of these entitlement programs. We used to talk about that in Washington, but the projections are terrible. Mm-hmm. You know, the fact is we're an aging society. And unless we get a sort of better balance between money coming into Social Security and money coming out, it's just going to chew up more and more of the federal budget going forward. And all of these, mm-hmm. you know, competitiveness-enhancing parts of the budget are going to get squeezed, including R&D.
Mm-hmm. Well, speaking of training, which you touched upon, of course, that takes you to sort of the Democratic response to this set of issues. And obviously, there was the TAA, Trade Adjustment Assistance,
right.
That both President Clinton and President Obama pursued. And in fact, I think President Obama kind of ramped it up.
He
with
was
the
able
stimulus.
To because of the crisis.
Yeah, with the stimulus package. Yeah. What did we learn from that? What worked and what didn't about it?
Well, I don't think trade adjustment assistance has ever worked very well. The history of this is really interesting. The program was actually created during the Kennedy administration. It was part of what was called the Trade Expansion Act of 1962. And Kennedy was reasonably passionate and profound about it. He gave a speech when he was introducing the legislation, sending the legislation to Congress, and he said, look, trade is a policy that's in our interests as a nation. It will make us collectively wealthier. It's important for our diplomacy. It's important for our national security. But some people will be harmed, and we can't pursue a policy that we believe is in the overall national interest and let a small subset of our population pay the entire price. It was a rather profound idea. Unfortunately, the reality just never followed. The first 6 years after the program was created, there wasn't a single American worker who collected a dime in trade adjustment assistance because they defined the scope of the program so narrowly. And it's continued to be a tiny program. I mean, the United States spends as a fraction of its economy about one-fifth or one-sixth on worker retraining than the average European country. I mean, the Germans spend far more on this, the Swedes, the Danes, the Netherlands, everywhere else. So we've never really had a big commitment to it. That said, even if you're committed to it, it's hard to make retraining work, partly because of the people who are displaced. I mean, a lot of people losing their manufacturing jobs are mid-career, often men, though not exclusively, a lot of women too, with high school level educations. Training them for the demands of the new economy is really hard. And so retraining has been spotty. I mean, I think it's been way underfunded, but even if it were better funded, it's not a panacea. The other problem, which I think is really underappreciated, is the mobility problem. You know, a lot of these jobs have been lost in small cities, large towns, where there were one or two factories that really were the anchors of the economy. You know, when they disappeared, there was no economy left. The other jobs were, you know, if you were lucky, $10 an hour jobs. Maybe a, you know, job as a corrections officer in the jail might pay 12 or 13, but not very good jobs. And so what you really needed was for a lot of those people to move. But Americans don't move anymore. We used to move at twice the rate of the Europeans. We used to follow economic opportunities, and we've stopped doing that. And I don't entirely know why. But I think one of the reasons, and it shows how all these things are connected, I think one of the reasons is actually cost of living. So if you lose your job in a little town, the value of your house goes down the tubes. You know, if you're lucky, you walk away with a few bucks from your house. Well, there are a lot of jobs in the Bay Area, but how the heck are you going to live here? Yeah. How the heck are you going to live here? And I think for a lot of people, that becomes absolutely prohibitive, even if they might be willing to leave their town, which they don't want to, but they might be willing to. The economic obstacles to relocation are enormous, and so they're stuck.
There's some communities where you've seen that unusual players have stepped up. I'm thinking of Detroit, where, in fact, foundations came in, played a big sort of leveraging role. Yeah. A medium-sized business, Quicken Loans, came in and played an enormously helpful role. Are you seeing that kind of thing happen more and more, or is Detroit a kind of a unique instance?
I mean, you are. I think, you know, Detroit is still, if you go to Detroit, there's this sort of little zone of prosperity in the downtown and still, you know, a lot of not very healthy economic areas surrounding the city. But it's been encouraging. It's definitely been positive. They've worked hard on the training piece with Wayne State University there. As you say, Gilbert's put a lot of money into real estate, refurbishing it. They've tried to offer space as incubators for startup companies. So you do see a lot of this in different places. There are good state initiatives on retraining. South Carolina's got probably the best apprenticeship program in the country. There are a lot of places that are starting up computer coding boot camps. There are a lot of interesting local initiatives. It's not really scaled up yet. It's kind of scattered stuff around the country. And of course, there are a lot of initiatives coming out of companies and universities and private individuals and others, all of which are very encouraging. But I think without some greater support at the governmental level, it's going to be hard to scale these things up.
You're listening to World Affairs, the weekly broadcast of the World Affairs Council. We're hearing from Edward Alden. He's a senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations. This event was recorded in San Francisco before a World Affairs audience. Ours is a membership organization, and since our founding 70 years ago, we've been dedicated to engaging the public in conversations that matter. You can visit us at worldaffairs.org. And now back to our conversation with Ted Alden.
Well, as you think of recent presidents, they've tended to come to office with a kind of comprehensive competitiveness agenda, with a package. And in the case of both Clinton and Obama, they were thwarted. They weren't able to get their packages through. Now you've got a president who has a Congress in his own party, right? I'm not sure you have a coherent agenda yet, but are you starting to see the makings of some coherent agenda? And do you think that this opportunity to have your own party in Congress could lead to such an outcome?
Well, I can't say I'm positive at the moment. I mean, on my optimistic days, I see the potential for a political realignment. Because if I look at the trade issue, which I followed very closely, you basically had pro-business Republicans who liked trade liberalization because it was really good for the private sector. And it has been really good for U.S. companies. I mean, U.S. companies are a lot of them in the top of the world scale. And then you had Democrats who were in various ways beholden to the labor unions, who were very skeptical of it. And on the trade issue, that's been the political divide. That is not sustainable anymore. It's actually really interesting to look at the public opinion polls. If you ask people whether they think trade has been a good or a bad thing for the United States, almost two-thirds of Democratic voters today say trade's a good thing. Republicans have gone the other way.
Yeah,
it's about fewer than 40% of Republican voters now say trade's a good thing, which is ironic because in the Congress, right, the Republicans are pro-trade and the Democrats are not. So there's going to be some kind of political realignment. And in my optimistic days, I think, you know, the sort of moderate version of economic nationalism that Trump has in part represented maybe can line up in some way with the Democrats who've been concerned about the impacts of trade and come up with a more positive agenda to help some of the folks who, as I described in my book, were left behind. So far, if you look at what Trump's doing, I don't see that. As I say, you know, the healthcare bill is going to hurt a lot of those people. You know, every other country we compete with in the advanced world has universal healthcare. They have universal health insurance. And so if you lose your job, at least it doesn't mean you can't go to the doctor anymore. So, you know, you take that away, and Obamacare didn't get us all the way there, but it got us a little bit of the way there at least. That's going to hurt those people. If you look at the tax cut package that the president has proposed, I think there's nothing in there for a lot of the people who put him in office. It's mostly going to go to the high earners. As you mentioned, you know, infrastructure's now on the back burner. So I do not at the moment see this president pursuing an agenda that tends towards my optimistic scenario.
Mm. A lot of the questioners have asked about education. And I'll try to see if I can turn it into just one question. If in fact we're all going to have not only multiple jobs in our lifetime, multiple employers, but multiple careers in our lifetimes, what kind of education is the right one to prepare us for that world?
I mean, the simple answer is constant education. I mean, I hate to quote Tom Friedman, but he had a pretty good column this morning in which, you know, he said, look, you know, I hate to quote him because his books sell better than mine do, but you know, what he said is, you know, we've had a model for a long time where, and you know, those of us who have kids, we still do this to some extent, you know, what's your career path, right? You know, you're going to finish high school, you're going to go to university, and what job do you want? And we kind of think of it that way. But, you know, realistically, people are going to hold multiple jobs over the course of their careers. And it's not just going to be, you know, this is your education, and that's going to take you through the rest of your life. I think clearly a lot of us are going to have to go back to school in various forms throughout our lives. And we're not structured to do that. I mean, I've got a new paper coming out with my colleague Bob Lighton, who's done a lot of good work on entrepreneurship, where we argue for the idea of, you know, essentially career lifetime learning loans, where people can borrow the way you would borrow as a student at any time in your career for any sort of education with payment contingent on the level of income. So if you do very well, you're going to pay the full loan back. If you don't do quite so well, you'll only pay part of it. The government will subsidize and make up the difference. You know, you want people to be committed to the education they're doing. That's one way to do it. You do see companies getting more serious about it. Really interesting article in Fortune a month or so ago about AT&T, which is retraining 100,000 of its employees, about 40% of its employees, because the new I'm not a telecoms guy, but the new switching technology demands a fundamentally different set of skills than the old switching technology. And AT&T sees no way that they can go off and hire 100,000 people. They got to retrain their own people, and they've created a lot of incentives for their employees to go back to school and train for these new positions. I think that is the sort of thing that we are going to need, but it's going to need to involve, you know, it's going to need to involve governments at all levels. It's going to need to involve companies at all levels. We're far less serious in the private sector about this than, say, the German companies are.
Right.
And it's going to involve us as individuals. We're going to have to take it on ourselves to realize that throughout our lives, we're going to need to learn mm-hmm. new things.
So the resilience that takes, though, the agility that takes, has more to do with the first 1,000 years of life when you're developing your sort of social and emotional intelligence than it does by the time you get to school or get to an apprenticeship and get into the job. Are we as a country making that investment in early childhood?
No. I mean, we don't do Head Start, and the data on Head Start's pretty good. You know,
yep.
Preschool for everybody pays real benefits. It's interesting when you look at we had another book that you mentioned, the Renewing America Initiative that I'm part of at the council. We published a book at the beginning of 2016 called How America Stacks Up. And it was an effort to compare to the United States to other advanced economies in a bunch of areas that are important to competitiveness. So, corporate tax, worker retraining, infrastructure. We had a chapter on education, chapter on innovation. U.S., I will say, is way ahead on innovation. It's because of all you folks here. But education, the education story is really interesting. There's sort of two things that surprised me when I did the research. One is that, you sort of think from reading the headlines that, oh my God, we're falling back in education, and, each generation is doing worse than the previous one. That's not actually true. Our level of educational attainment has stayed fairly stable. Problem is the rest of the world's just leaping ahead. Mm. And if you look at why, I think if you had to point to one reason why the United States became the most successful economy in the world, is that we did mass education earlier than any other nation. We, universal high school education, the GI Bill to get folks to university, we were way ahead of the world. Now we've kind of stalled and the rest of the world is moving ahead. The other thing that's quite striking in education is just, and this is a larger theme, I think, in everything we're talking about tonight, is just the enormous inequality. The difference between our best schools, which are fabulous. I mean, my kids go to public schools in the DC suburbs in Maryland. I mean, their schools would be up there with the best public schools anywhere in the world. Mm-hmm. But you go to the inner city schools in Washington, D.C., and they're worse than the schools in a lot of poor countries. Yeah. And we've just got this massive inequality problem in education that we have not solved.
That locks in inequality.
And it
for
locks
life.
In inequality for life. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So one of the questioners asked about the concept of a universal basic income and wondered what you thought of that.
And
you might want to describe the concept.
Yeah, so the idea of a universal basic income is that basically the government hands everybody a check for an amount of money which would be enough for them to survive at some very modest level, even if they couldn't find paid employment. Mm-hmm. The numbers that are often suggested are something like $10,000 or $12,000, which is not very much money, but it would maybe keep the wolf away from the door. Andy Stern, who is the president of Service Employees Union, I worked with him on a task force project on trade policy. I like Andy a lot. He's got a book out advocating universal basic income. I think he makes a lot of compelling arguments. I have two problems with it. One is just it's extraordinarily expensive, and I just don't think politically it's all that likely. Two, my bigger problem is, and it's partly from talking to the sort of people who got, lost their jobs in the 2000s, I think work is really important to people. When the factory jobs went away, I think it wasn't that they loved the factory work. Like, factory work is monotonous, it's hard, it's physically difficult, but they loved the community. Right? They had friends, they hung out at the union hall, they bowled together, they went out for a beer after work together. It was sort of a center of life. And I think for a lot of us, work is just a very important part of our identity, our social life, our community. And some of the idea of having, millions of Americans collecting checks from the government every month and sitting at home playing video games, I just find that really depressing. I think that the national challenge is to create work that pays a living wage and figure out how to do that and what are the various components of that. including, you know, where necessary, work that's government generated, you know, I mean, like we did in the 1930s, you know, I'm a hiker. Everything that I enjoy around this country when I go off in the summers, it was all built in the 1930s. Like all the hiking trails, all the lodges, all of that was done in the 1930s. Why can't we do that again? Right?
But of course, what this is an argument over the role of government.
Right? It is.
It's not an argument over what's a good thing, but it's who does it?
I would rather have government doing things that create better jobs for more Americans than have government doing massive redistribution through UBI. I mean, don't get me wrong. I think our tax system should be in various ways more progressive than it is, but we should do it in ways that encourage work. I mean, one example would be the earned income tax credit mm-hmm. that was put in place in the Clinton administration, which is basically, you know, rebatable tax credit for low income workers. So it tops up your take home pay, but you have to have a job to collect. Another idea that I think has been very underused is wage insurance. So, you know, you lose your $28 an hour job in the General Motors. You're not really able to move. You know, the next best job in town pays $12 an hour. Why not top up the difference? So what's that? 14, 19 bucks an hour. So the government tops it up to 19 bucks an hour. So that worker doesn't take such a big hit. You could do it on a temporary basis in the hope, you know, the current program calls for 2 years. I could honestly make an argument for doing it on a permanent basis. One of the fascinating things about this David Autor, Gordon Hansett, David Dorn research was they were not only kind of able to trace the places that lost jobs as a result of Chinese import competition, they went and looked at what happened to the individuals who lost work. Most of them didn't find new jobs. Very few of them actually went on trade adjustment assistance. What an awful lot of them did on was they ended up on Social Security Disability, which is a program if you can persuade a doctor that, you know, you've got a soft tissue industry or something else that makes it impossible for you to go back to work, you begin collecting Social Security at whatever age you are, you know, age 45 or 50 or 55. You're basically on Social Security for the rest of your life. We now spend $168 billion annually on Social Security Disability. Mm. You could do a lot of wage insurance. You could do a much more generous earned income tax credit for a lot less than $168 billion. So I think we're not actually spending our money wisely on this.
So who's listening to you? Are there leaders?
We are, Jay.
We are. But are there leaders? Are you seeing on Capitol Hill, among legislators who are not happy with this status quo, are you seeing them coming together around a set of issues, a set of solutions that are evidence-based? Or is the disarray on both sides?
I am not seeing them coming together. And to be clear, the Republican Party is enormously divided. And I'm honestly, at this point, I don't know who the champion of this sort of stuff is going to be on the Republican side. I haven't really seen the emergence yet. There's a lot more interest on the Democratic side. I've had more calls from Democratic lawmakers and their staff since my book came out than ever before. And I think there is an effort going on the Democratic side to rethink a lot of these issues. I think they realized that they really kind of blew it in the election. I was in Milwaukee recently. I hadn't clued into this. Hillary Clinton never went to Wisconsin. Not once. I mean, the Democrats had, you know, Democratic presidential candidates had won Wisconsin every year since 1984. And I guess she took it for granted. But people in Wisconsin noticed that. And they're like, the Democrats don't care about us anymore, right? You know, they care about their urban constituents. I was mentioning to you before, there's a wonderful new book out by Amy Goldstein, the Washington Post reporter, called Janesville, that looks at what happened in Janesville, Wisconsin, Speaker Ryan's hometown, after the GM plant went belly up in 2008. You know, those were people who were clamoring for help, and Hillary never went there. And that kind of played out. You know, Donald Trump, whatever you want to say about Donald Trump, he went to those places, right? He went to Ohio, he went to Pennsylvania, he went to Wisconsin. He talked to those folks. Democrats didn't talk to them. Bill Clinton used to talk to them, but Hillary didn't. And I think a lot of the Democrats have realized that was a mistake, and they need to think about what are a set of policies that actually speak to the concerns of the people who voted for Donald Trump.
One of the question cards relates to the psychological side of all this. It refers to J.D. Vance's book, Hillbilly Elegy, and asks about a culture of defeatism, of blaming. And the questioner wants to know the degree to which this set of issues, the inability to cope with radical change, our failure on the policy side to address the dislocations, to what extent it has led to a breakdown of a loss of social capital, a loss of sense of community, a sense that there are whole swaths of the population that don't care about other swaths of the other portions of the population, the kind of thing that can tear a democracy apart in a way that economics alone cannot.
You know, I think you asked the question in the right way, because I think, you know, the debate is often, is this a cultural breakdown which then makes it impossible for people to find work? And is that sort of the cause and the economics are kind of secondary? And I think that's not the cause. I think economics drives all of this. You know, we used to talk in the 1960s, or people used to talk, I was a kid, but in the 1960s about, you know, the sort of culture of the inner city African-American communities. And was there a cultural problem there that was preventing economic advancement? And no, there was an economic opportunity problem. You know, a lot of the jobs were leaving the cities and there was an economic vacuum. Robert Putnam of Harvard wrote a very powerful book called Our Kids, in which he goes back to his hometown of Port Arthur, Ohio, and looks at what happened to his hometown. And basically what happened is the economy disappeared. And what happened to a lot of the people he grew up with? Well, ended up in cultural dysfunction in one way or another. You know, the marriage rates broke down, out-of-wedlock births among the kids went way up, drug addiction went way up. I think the loss of economic opportunity often leads to what looks like cultural breakdown. And then, of course, it's self-reinforcing, and I think that's what Vance gets out. Once you're in that position, it's very hard to get people back into the workforce because they can't pass a drug test. You know, they're not used to, you know, getting up at 6 o'clock in the morning to go to work every day. I mean, those things are hard, right? You know, I got out of bed at 5 o'clock this morning to get the plane to come down here to talk to her. I mean, you do have to kind of discipline yourself to work, and I think it's easy if you fall out of the habit. So it becomes a self-reinforcing thing. But if you ask me what the cause is, the driver here is economics. The cultural breakdown is a response to the loss of economic opportunity.
But is it also, I mean, I just picked this up because you opened by talking about the pace of change, and it's not just economic, right? It's demographic change. There are other shifts in your life doesn't look like it looked 20 years ago. And some people find that harder to adapt to than others.
I mean, I think there's no question, but I still do think the economic part of it is the most important. I think if you've got a good solid job, that, you know, you and your significant other can support a family, can support your kids. I think the fact that there are more people coming into your neighborhood who don't look like you kind of bothers you less. But if you've lost your job and you feel like you're competing with those people for the $10 an hour jobs or the $12 an hour jobs, I think that can flip over into you know, suspicion of immigrants and other people who you see as competition.
Because you see it, then it's a zero-sum game.
Then it's a zero-sum game, yeah, exactly.
So in your book, you refer to sort of globalization happening alongside two recessions, a spike in energy prices. And I'm mentioning this because this questioner asks about a looming crisis to come, and that is the crisis in student loans. Yeah. And so I know you may not be an expert in student loans, but this is, you know, it's another potential shock to the economy, coinciding with greater economic integration, coinciding with all that you write about.
I mean, I think it could be a significant shock. I think the student, I'm not an expert on student debt, but the burden is big and growing. And I think partly because, you know, at some level, young people have got the message, right? If you look at the wage statistics, if you don't get a college education, pretty hard to get ahead in the world now. I mean, I actually think we don't do enough on the sort of two-year, you know, technical college skills. I actually think that there are more jobs there than we're actually steering young people towards. But the message people have got, they've got to go to college. College is insanely expensive in this country. You know, I'm lucky. My kids were born in Canada. Canadian universities, you know, it's cheaper than in-state tuition. So you can go to Canadian University and not graduate with a mountain load of debt. It's very hard here. Even the in-state, you know, the schools, the University of California, right? Tuition keeps going up because the universities are starved for funding. So a lot of people borrow heavily to try and improve their life prospects, and then they graduate with this mountain of debt that weighs them down for the next 10 years. So yeah, I think that's a huge problem. Can I add one more shock that you all in this room know better than I do is coming, which is an enormous technology shock. So, you know, if you look on the trade front, there's not going to be another China shock. You know, China was such a big economy, so many people moving into the labor force. The only other country that could potentially do is India. And India, for a variety of reasons, has just never been the export-oriented economy that China became. So I don't think the next big displacement shock is going to be from trade. It's going to be from technology. You know, you're all busy perfecting driverless cars. Well, who are the first people that are going to be affected by driverless cars? The trucking industry. You know, the trucking companies are going to adopt this first because it'll be incredibly lucrative for them. There are 3 million truck drivers in this country, and the demographic not dissimilar from a lot of the auto workers, right? What are we going to do for those folks? And it's going to creep up, you know. I mean, artificial intelligence, you know, I was a journalist, right? Computers can write simple news stories now. You know, who won the baseball game last night? And so, you know, there are a lot of different professions that are going to be affected by this. So the problem of how we adapt to rapid change is not going away. I think it's going to get worse. I think trade will not be as much of a driver as it was. I think technology is going to be more of a driver.
So the optimists argue that we can all be employed. We just will need to, we won't need to work as long hours as we currently work. We won't have to have three jobs, which, of course, is so many people do now. I mean, so many people are Lyft or Uber drivers on the side of having also a full-time job. And that will, the quality of life will improve. What do you say to them?
I hope that's true, but
I think they're
assuming
a universal minimum.
I mean, it's going to require a set of structures that just are not in place, right? I mean, you know, what's the take-home pay going to be if we're working 25 hours a week instead of 55 hours a week? What's going to happen with health insurance? Are people going to be covered? I mean, a lot of people have to work because it's the only way you're going to get health insurance. You know, how are we going to, you know, there's a strong corporate interest in taking people who do the job better for the company than anybody else and working them as hard as they possibly can. I think there are real competitiveness issues. You know, I don't know how we sort of create this kinder sharing work kind of economy and compete globally. So I don't actually know how we figure all of that out, but I can't say, I mean, you know, economists have been talking about this going back to what Thorsten Veblen, I think, in the early part of the 20th century. We haven't seen it happen. And I don't really see the prospects for it happening. So I'm a little pessimistic.
Now, several of the questioners are asking for you to compare us to other countries. And you've done that a little bit, but not all that much.
No.
You've referred to the German system of apprenticeship. You've referred to the Canadian access to education, to higher education. As you look around and considering the pressures, for example, that Europe is experiencing with the true migrant crisis, as you look around, what countries do you think are doing the best job of helping their citizens to adapt to rapid change?
You know, it's interesting. On a lot of measures, the United States doesn't do badly, but I don't actually think we do as well as we think we do. And going back to that Peterson memo, you know, he wrote, I'm not going to get the line perfectly, but he said something like, the rest of the world for a long time has thought that we were an unassailably competitive economy. And even worse, we thought so too. And I think, you know, there is often a tendency, partly because of what happened with Japan, right? There was, you know, the fear that Japan was going to become this world dominant economy. And then it didn't. And so we said, you know, everything's fine. A lot of the U.S. numbers don't look so good. You know, if you look at things like labor force participation, our labor force participation rate is way down, right? It's down at the level of the early 1970s. There are a lot of people, even though our unemployment rate looks pretty good, there are a lot of people who are not in the labor force anymore. You know, if you look at Germany, the combination of their unemployment rate, which is considerably lower than ours, and their labor force participation rate, which is much higher, they're doing way better on this score. Even the UK is doing slightly better. You know, Denmark, Sweden, Netherlands, a lot of these countries are doing better on many of these measures. We do better on some things. We do really well on innovation. And I wouldn't trade our model of innovation for any country in the world. So if I had to select, you know, I'd select the U.S. for innovation. I'd select Germany for job training. Their apprenticeship system is gold standard. You know, I'd probably pick the Canadians for cultural civility in various ways. You know, and you kind of put all of that together. There's certainly a lot of things we do well, but there's also a lot of things we could learn from the rest of the world. And I think, unfortunately, we haven't been in the habit of looking to the rest of the world for lessons. I see that starting to change. You know, you do hear a lot more talk in states particularly about the German model of apprenticeship training and what can we adapt from there, what might work in this environment. And I encourage that sort of stuff. So I hope we do more of it.
So this questioner asks, does change happen from the top down or bottom up? And I know you devote a good part of your book to local initiative as well. So say something about that.
I think it does happen from the bottom up. I'm basically a journalist at heart, even though I still work for the Council on Foreign Relations. All of my early training was in journalism, and journalists are way better at analyzing and describing problems than they are at coming up with solutions. But one of the things you have to do when you're at the Council on Foreign Relations is you have to have your solutions chapter. So having identified all these problems, you have to pretend to be able to solve them. The closest I was able to get, and I do think it has some merit, is in my last chapter, I called for a bottoms-up competitiveness strategy. And what I mean by that, it's quite interesting to look at how economic development strategies played out in the United States. We've never really done this at a national level, but lots of states do it. In fact, if you look at the sort of rise of economic planning at the state level, some of it goes way back in the southern states to the 1930s, but it really took off in the 1980s in the face of Japanese competition. You know, and while the U.S. government was busy saying, you know, trade is great and we'll all be fine, the states were thinking, well, what pieces are going to fall here, right? What are our exporters? Are they going to succeed? How are we going to attract foreign investment? How are we going to make sure that companies actually have the workforce they need to succeed? There are, I think, 170-some state trade offices in foreign countries now around the world. A lot of states do this on their own. And so I argue in my book that we really, at the national level, need to be supporting these state initiatives. We need to be working with the states to try to succeed more in the global market. I mean, one of the just small changes I recommend is if you look at who the government takes advice from on trade, it's almost entirely from U.S. multinational corporations. And I mean, I don't have a problem with multinational companies, right? We need our companies to do well, but their interests aren't necessarily U.S. interests. They have global interests, right? They'll invest wherever they can make a profit. I would love to see a much stronger voice for state and local economic development officials who are, you know, trying to develop the, you know, the next successful solar industry, or trying to help their startups compete in the global market, or doing all the things which are about, you know, creating jobs and opportunity here in the United States. I think those are the voices that the trade policymakers in Washington should be listening to. So that's actually the next paper I'm writing. It's just been hard to get to it. But I recommend it in sort of a skeleton way in my book, and I want to flesh out that idea. So that's my next project.
Well, would you please join me in thanking Ted Alden?
Thank you.
You've been listening to World Affairs, the weekly broadcast of the World Affairs Council. In this conversation, we spoke to Ted Alden, Senior Fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations. This program is one of many that we have hosted at World Affairs, and we're about to celebrate our 70th anniversary. To give a sense of where we come from, more than 70 years ago, back in 1945, leaders from 50 countries came together in San Francisco to draft the United Nations Charter. And when those leaders returned to their respective capitals, Bay Area citizens decided that they wanted to keep the conversation going. And so in 1947, the World Affairs Council was born. In celebration of the 70th anniversary of our founding and in anticipation of the possibilities that await, on June 7, we'll be hosting the 70th Anniversary Awards Dinner at the Fairmont Hotel in San Francisco, where the UN Charter was signed. The event is an opportunity for us to recognize the leaders who expanded and connected our universe over the past 70 years. They include General William Draper, Jr., for his role in building the financial institutions of the Marshall Plan. Also, former Secretary of State George Shultz for building down nuclear weapons in Europe and managing the peaceful dissolution of the Warsaw Pact. We'll also honor Internet pioneer Bob Metcalfe. He co-created the Ethernet. And we'll celebrate astronaut Kathy Sullivan, the first American woman to walk in space. We will also honor outstanding social entrepreneurs whose impact we're just beginning to experience. These are innovators who will shape our future, much like the leaders I've cited have shaped our past. We hope you'll be with us. To purchase a ticket or sponsor a table, visit us on worldaffairs.org. And for those who've enjoyed this and other broadcasts, they're made possible by the support of Chevron, as well as Peter and Kathy Robertson, McKinsey, Wells Fargo, Bank of the West, and Bloomberg. Our recording engineer is Stanton Burns. Our technical supervisor is Monte Carlos. World Affairs is produced in association with KQED Public Radio. I'm Jane Wales. Thank you for joining us.